What happens when you squeeze the diversity of human bodies into just two categories? The answer is people try and make it work. I'm Peter McGuire, and this is my unlikely explanation. I want to give a warning up front. This episode discusses sexuality and anatomy and the language around those topics, so I might be using some explicit terms, and in quoting from the past or describing movements of the past using terms that could be considered slurs. So if you don't want to hear rude or explicit terms, this might not be the episode for you, or you might want to listen to it after the little ones have gone to bed. This is the second part of a two-part episode, but this episode can be enjoyed alone if you're not as passionate about eunuchs as I am. In the first section, I examined bodies in politics by looking at bodies that were depicted or were actually altered to be non-binary, bodies that were neither male nor female. In this episode, I want to look more broadly at the imposition of the gender binary on the societies and individuals throughout early modern and modern history. Once you see gender binary as a cultural meme rather than an eternal fact, it's easy to identify ways that it shapes culture and discussion. People who do not fit comfortably into the gender binary and the procreative order find different ways to survive and thrive. By looking at their stories, we can see the limits of the power of gender. In part one, I discuss the relationship between procreation and power. In trying to explain why eunuchs are no longer a class or gender in the world, I think we can safely say that part of the reason is the waning power of hereditary monarchs. Of the top 25 contributors to the UN, which is a measure of wealth and influence, only one, Saudi Arabia, has a hereditary ruler today. But the waning of hereditary power is only half of the story. The places on Earth where eunuchs existed later in history, the Ottoman and Chinese empires, did away with eunuchs to better conform to the Western system of power. The final demise of the eunuch came when European culture monopolized global power. Outside of the Christian world, eunuchs held an additional position that did not exist in Christian empires. Christian procreative power was based on monogamy. In Western Christendom, this meant that a man could only have one legal wife at a time, and only children of that wife could inherit. Eastern Christianity took this a step further by limiting men to only two marriages in a lifetime. The logic was that consecutive marriages on earth meant multiple marriages in heaven once everyone had died, and that would be bigamy. Presumably, the second marriage was a compromise with the earthly necessity for legitimate heirs, given the high death rate of the time. In the 9th century, the Roman Emperor Leo VI ran afoul of the church when his first two wives died within a year of each other without giving birth, and then his semi-legitimate third wife also died without issue. He ultimately had a son with his mistress before demanding that they be legitimized by the church, probably knowing that this would be an uphill battle that he could only afford to fight once. This required tremendous political maneuvering, including appealing to the Pope over the Patriarch, which pushed the Church another step closer to schism. A huge advantage that the non-Christian aristocrats had over their Christian counterparts is that they could usually take more than one wife, and some prominent members of society sired literally hundreds of children. A monarch in Morocco in the 18th century, Ismail ibn Sharif, registered 525 sons and 342 daughters. Caring for the wives and children of the ruler could become a major cost of government administration, and the harem could play a major role in non-Christian government administration. Because they were cut off from procreation, eunuchs were perfectly suited to shepherd the procreation of others. Not being able to sire children, placing eunuchs in charge of harems could dispel any suspicion of illegitimacy from the children. The accusation of illegitimacy was often used to undermine the political power of monarchs. But of course, having so many legitimate children causes inheritance problems of its own, and invites the other kind of succession war, the kind where there's too many heirs. Looking at a map, we can see a decline from east to west in attitudes towards non-binary gender. In China and sporadically across Asia, we see eunuchs as accepted members of the court and harem life. We also see social positions for a third gender. An example of a third gender that has survived through history is in Thailand, which is not incidentally the only Asian country to escape European imperialism. You might be familiar with the Kathui people in Thailand, members of this gender that can encompass Western categories of trans women, intersex, and effeminate homosexuals. Court eunuchs existed in Chinese administration until 1912, when revolutionaries ousted the emperor and declared China to be a republic. The last person to be castrated for court duty was Sun Yat-ting, whose father castrated him only a few months before the last Qing emperor, Puyi, abdicated. Puyi became emperor just shy of his third birthday, and apparently treated his court like the spoiled child he was. He later said, quote, "Flogging eunuchs was part of my daily routine. My cruelty and love of wielding power were already too firmly set for persuasion to have any effect on me." He also said, quote, "No account of my childhood would be complete without mentioning the eunuchs. They waited on me when I ate, dressed, and slept. They accompanied me on my walks and to my lessons. They told me stories, and they had rewards and beatings from me, but they never left my presence. They were my slaves, and they were my earliest teachers." He abdicated a few days after his sixth birthday. Sun Yat-ting grew up in poverty and was castrated in the mud-walled home of his birth with no anesthetic. A goose quill was inserted into his urethra to prevent it from becoming blocked while the wound healed. When he recovered from the injury, the Emperor Puyi no longer held power, but he still had a title and a court, which had retreated into the Forbidden City. No sooner had Sun worked his way into this inner court than it was expelled from the capital entirely. Years later, when Japan invaded China on the eve of the Second World War, Sun worked in Puyi's puppet empire in Manchuria. Sun apparently developed a keen sense for political maneuvering because he escaped Soviet occupation, survived the ensuing civil war, and found his way into communist administration. He found himself constantly targeted by the regime as a holdover from the decadent imperial past that communist propaganda railed against, and eventually lost power in a leftist coup. It was during this time that he suffered his second greatest emotional loss. To conform with the Cultural Revolution of 1966 to 76, Sun's family destroyed the pickled remains of his genitals, which severed his trust in his family forever. He had hoped to be buried with his genitals and become complete again after death. Remarkably, he lived to the age of 94 and died peacefully in Beijing in 1996, having survived some of the most dangerous and turbulent years in Chinese history. As we continue westwards on the map, we come to Persia and the Middle East, where there have been court eunuchs since ancient times. The Arab conquests in the 7th century eliminated eunuchs from power for a time, and early caliphates appear to have excluded eunuchs even as harem guards. Eunuchs reemerge in the 12th century as a royal slave guard that could be trusted to stay out of the Sunni-Shiite controversy. Castration was illegal under Islamic law, so slaves would be transported to Coptic Christian lands in Upper Egypt to be castrated, and then were sold out of Cairo. Eunuchs eventually began to reach high positions in court and religious duties around the 16th century, after Turks invaded the Roman Empire and the Middle East. Under Ottoman rule, black eunuchs and white eunuchs were given different roles, with white eunuchs supervising page boys and black eunuchs supervising harems. The logic was that while white slaves traditionally kept their penis, black slaves traditionally had it removed, and therefore black eunuchs would be safer to keep around women. The extent to which this is true in practice is unclear. The Kizlar Agha, or chief black eunuch, supervised the royal harem and oversaw the network of eunuch guards that defended the holy sites of Mecca and Medina, as well as the government charitable foundations. Women of the harem were often involved in court intrigues, and this proximity to the royal family meant that black eunuchs traditionally held more prestigious positions in government. All this proximity to wealth and power made the Kizlar Agha one of the most powerful people in the imperial administration up until the 19th century. Eunuch power was curtailed by the reforms of Mahmud II in the 1830s, which sought to reorganize and centralize the empire into a Western-style monarchy. All remaining eunuch positions were eliminated by the Young Turk Revolution in 1908, which was a nationalist and republican coup carried out by the military. The Ottoman Empire of the time was under great pressure from European powers that held castration in particular and the slave trade in general to be barbaric. Eunuchs had come to be seen as a holdover from the inefficient, decadent past and an obstacle to entering the modern era of cooperation with Europe. Then we have the Roman world, where, as we discussed in the last episode, eunuchs' entry into Roman society was concurrent with the takeover of the Republic by emperors. Emperors suddenly needed eunuchs around. Castration remained illegal for citizens, but there was this fiction of the swaddling accident that allowed citizens to castrate their sons semi-licitly. The Roman Empire was much more comfortable with eunuchs by the 10th century, and no doubt imparted their ideas about eunuchs onto the Turks who conquered their empire. And then we get to the European world, which came to be populated by the Germanic peoples, who conquered the Western Roman Empire, where castration was rarely practiced. This mix of Germanic and Roman peoples came to form the European culture, and European culture never recognized eunuchs or any other third gender as legitimate. While the Eastern Church had several eunuch patriarchs, in the West it was said that castration of priests removed the temptation that makes celibacy worthwhile to practice. At the same time, Western monasteries forbid eunuchs admittance because they pose too much of a sexual temptation to priests. This is in keeping with the contradictory attitudes towards eunuchs we explored in the last episode. Western civilization saw itself as the successor of Greek and Roman civilization. We still do. Look at our national architecture. As late as 1922, we built a Greek temple to house a statue of Lincoln. Never mind that Europeans were the Germanic tribes that conquered Western Rome. Never mind that the Roman Empire still very much existed throughout the Middle Ages in the East. The idea that the West represents vitality, discipline, and individualism in the face of Eastern despotism has been taken up uncritically by historians stretching back to Herodotus, and by mainstream culture until relatively recently, when we started examining it a few decades ago. The story we tell about ourselves sees Greeks as fiercely independent, clever, scrappy pioneers who were able to turn back the monolithic evil that is Eastern Empire through heroism and virtue. A perfect example of this view can be seen in Zack Snyder's 2006 film 300, which retains much of the Orientalism from Herodotus' telling of the same events in 340 BCE. 300 Spartans are said to have held the pass at Thermopylae against the impossibly large Persian army until they were betrayed. The Persians act as ants in an enormous soulless despotism. Every Persian is a slave, very much like the others. Xerxes is shown with his elongated and effeminate body with his eyeliner. Comparing his body to King Leonidas tells us who the manly men are. The heroic Spartans succeed against impossible odds and are only brought down at the last minute by the treachery of a person with severe physical deformities. His body is imperfect. Easterners can only beat Westerners, even in a completely one-sided battle, if they resort to tactics and allies that are below the heroic and manly standards of the Greeks. In reality, Persia was a complex, multi-ethnic empire that paid unprecedented respect to the cultures that it conquered. Dan Carlin did an excellent three-part series on them. But never mind reality, the Western civilization myth pays little attention to it and to Alexander's despotism with the Hellenic Greeks, and jumps forward in time to the Romans, who supposedly codified and rationalized all forms of law and power. With the introduction of Semitic Christian ideas and the conversion of the Roman Empire to Christianity, the story of Western civilization is complete. It is proud, pious, manly, and independent, while the East, the Oriental world, is decadent, servile, and effeminate. Unlike the Greeks and Romans, Christians stigmatized non-heterosexual sex acts, and they came to be seen as effeminate, evil, and Eastern. This set of Eastern stereotypes are roughly termed Orientalist, since the publication of Edward Said's 1978 book, Orientalism. After the fall of Constantinople to the Turks, eunuchs disappeared from Christendom. In the Christian mind, they became an exclusively Oriental concept. Europeans wouldn't give much thought to eunuchs again until the middle of the Age of Colonization, in the 18th century. A new interest in the Orient had seized Europe. In Paris, porcelain figurines of Turks were selling like hotcakes. A fascination with the East, typified as a strange and exotic place, gripped the European mind. In particular, they wanted to peek inside of the harem, this secret place of sensual pleasures, guarded by the sexless eunuchs. The Europeans tended to eroticize harems as given to barbaric lusts of polygamists. In reality, harems of the Muslim world served as a form of hijab, intended to seclude female relatives of all kinds, preserve their modesty, and provide education for their children. Eunuchs were seen in the West as the most unfortunate victims of the Oriental penchant for despotism. Oriental despots were so tyrannical that they would literally emasculate their subjects, Europeans tittered. This Western fascination and disgust with Oriental ideas of gender came to have a very real impact on people's lives as Western imperialism tightened its control over Asian life in the 19th century. India presents an interesting case study. In India, to this day, there is a third sex referred to in most parts of the country as Hijra, although the term can be considered derogatory. Hijra historically occupy their own caste and are crucial participants in certain religious rites, particularly with reference to gods that have both sexes, or stories wherein male and female gods merge. In Hindu philosophy, they are thought to not express sexual desire and instead transmute their sexual energy into religious energy. These are broad generalizations that I'm using to describe thousands of years of history and literature, but it's worth stressing that Hijra meant many different things in different times and places. Unfortunately, I haven't put the years of work into Indian history that I have into Byzantine history, so I apologize. This is going to be a bit of a generalization. Despite the lofty religious associations of the Hijra social class, Hijra experienced the same discrimination that trans people experience the world over. Hijra face widespread job and housing discrimination, high rates of poverty and homelessness, and a high incidence of sex work. It appears as though Hijra are only valued for their service, essentially their dancing and singing for religious events, and are shut out of other parts of public life. As a result, a common way that Hijra make money is dancing or singing obnoxiously with the intent to embarrass a person or business into paying them to go away. This is a particularly gendered form of begging, using the stigmatism of their class and their bodies to extort money from people who don't want to be associated with them. It's also worth mentioning that sex work was a common part of Hijra life going back through history, so far as we can tell. It's hard to know how much of the shunning of Hijra is Western in origin, as India fell under European domination throughout the 17th and 18th centuries. Western lawmakers set Indian castes into a Western-style legal system, which violently disrupted the traditional Indian social system. Part of this systemization was a rejection of Hijra completely. Europeans understood them to be eunuchs, due in part to the ceremonial rite of becoming Hijra, which involves complete castration. That said, it's debated how commonly castration was or is actually practiced. The British Raj illegalized castration, prostitution, and sodomy in 1861, which illegalized all sex involving Hijra as an unnatural act, since they could be classified as neither man nor woman. It wasn't until the 2010s that various efforts were made to decriminalize homosexuality in India, culminating in a 2018 Supreme Court decision that struck down the Unnatural Acts article, which essentially made Hijra sexuality legal for the first time in 150 years. This clash between the colonial era Europeans and Indians over sexuality and gender represents two ends of a wide spectrum, this decline in attitudes that I was talking about, meeting. Eunuchs as a class disappeared from the world because of the imposition of the Western gender binary on places that formerly had other options. This lack of a legitimate third gender had far-reaching implications for people who don't fit comfortably within the man-woman binary. Because the West lacked a third gender, we made do with two. The gender binary came to be seen as a biological and necessary fact. The myth that God created Adam and Eve, man and woman, as opposite sexes, designed for coupling, placed special emphasis on sex as procreation. In part one of this episode, we discuss the dangers of focusing power structures on procreation. Focusing all sex on procreation is also an uncomfortable imposition into the lives of everyday people. I discussed how Elizabeth and Victoria had their bodies manipulated in art to conform to visions of femininity. Ordinary women also faced this choice between virginity and mass procreation, the other option being largely the tragedy of barrenness and the prostitution of fallen women. While it is true that many women were content to spend their 20s and 30s pregnant or recovering from pregnancy, some women were not. Like Elizabeth, some of these women cut themselves off from marriage and children entirely. I'm going to tell a few stories of people who were raised as girls and presented as men in adulthood. Some reassumed their feminine identities later, either by choice or because their bodies were outed and they were disallowed to continue living as men. To use our current term, transgender, to describe this group would be to miss the central fact of their existence. Women presented as men so that they could enjoy male privilege. It's an almost universal fact of human society that male privilege provides access to power and opportunities that are denied to women. In recent times, this fact has come to be identified, and initial attempts have been made to dismantle it. But for most of history, there have been enormous advantages to presenting as a man. While access to power can be an element in transness today, the term transgender usually refers to people who identify personally with a gender other than the one assigned to them at birth. Throughout history, the cross-dressing women, or boy girls, or women who marry women, as they've been termed, mostly choose life as men to have the freedom to experience the world. To call them transgender assumes something about their personal identity and feelings that we can't know. Because many of these individuals never spoke or wrote about living as a man. It was a complete secret. We also can't know their reasons for living as a man other than the social pressure to do so. As Ralph Carwinio, a female man who was exposed in 1914, told reporters at the time, "It is easier, far easier, for a girl to don trousers and get along as a man than it is for her to continue to wear skirts. She can remain a better girl, for she is not subjected to the dangers and temptations that befall lone girls when their sex is known." Many of these stories come from times of war. Christian Kit Kavanagh was apparently born in Dublin in 1667. I say apparently because all information about her seems to ultimately come from a source that might be fictional or semi-fictional, but her existence seems to be accepted within British military sources, so I will treat her as mostly factual. Kavanagh grew up as a girl, and as a woman, she showed great business acumen as the sole proprietor of a pub she inherited from her aunt. She married, and her husband became her waiter. Under circumstances that are unclear, her husband, Richard, disappeared in 1691. Kavanagh left their three children in the care of her mother and joined up with the army to search for him. Over the next 13 years, Kavanagh, now passing as a man, fought in several battles. He was expelled from the army after fighting a duel over a woman, but quickly re-enlisted as a dragoon. He apparently fought bravely and earned the admiration of his peers both in battle and in the marauding after battles. He was said to be ferocious. After a musket ball injury to the thigh put him on guard duty, Kavanagh finally reunited with his husband, who was a private in the 1st Regiment of Foot and had been captured by the French. Unfortunately, Richard, the husband, had already given up hope that he would ever be reunited with his wife and had started a new romantic relationship. Kavanaugh decided to continue fighting with the army as a man, and the couple stayed close, claiming to be brothers. Marion Broderick writes in Wild Irish Women that, quote, "Amazingly, she managed to conceal herself as a man without being discovered. She ate with them, drank with them, slept with them, played cards with them, even urinated alongside them, using what she describes as a silver tube with leather straps. No one was ever the wiser." One detail that shows up in this story and many stories like it, to the point where it's probably like a standard embellishment, like a meme, is that a prostitute accused Kavanaugh of fathering her child, and he opted to pay child support rather than reveal his female sex. Soldiering is dangerous business, though, and it was only a matter of time before Kit Kavanaugh suffered another injury, this time to the head. During his unconsciousness, a doctor's examination revealed his female body, and word quickly spread through the camp and then up the ranks. After his recovery, during which he remained an active soldier, Kavanaugh was discharged from the army and came to be known as Mrs. Welch, after her husband's last name. She worked as a sutleress, a merchant who followed armies around to sell them food, a sort of freelance canteen cook. After that husband was killed in battle, Mrs. Welch came to be Mrs. Jones, after her new husband, who was a dragoon. He also promptly died. As the War of Spanish Succession wound down, she returned to Dublin to run another pub, where in 1713 she married for the third time to another soldier. She had a type, a Mr. Davies. For her extraordinary service, she was given a pension by Queen Anne of £50, as well as 1 shilling a day for the rest of her life. Mrs. Davies was admitted into the Royal Hospital Chelsea, where esteemed veterans spend their declining years, and was buried with full military honors in 1739. Kit Kavanaugh was one of several wartime crossdressers. These women are usually described as being so driven by religious or political devotion that they must present as men in order to participate in war. In the account of Kit Kavanaugh, she claims that she joined the army due to being delirious to show my zeal for His Majesty King William and my country. Probably the most famous wartime crossdresser was Jeanne d'Arc, who was burned at the stake for crossdressing following her shocking revival of the French war effort during the Hundred Years' War and her subsequent capture by the English. It seems that cross-dressing young women for safety on the lawless roads of France had become a common precaution, and this is how her cross-dressing started. She apparently continued to prefer male clothes while she was in English captivity because they helped her fend off the constant rape attempts by her captors. That was a horrible sentence to write, and it will be made even worse by the next one. She was dressed in a long white dress when she was executed by burning at age 19. The social disruption of war pushes women to cross-dress both for protection and because it opens up opportunities for social mobility. These women are romanticized in writing as Valkyries or Amazons, with special attention being paid to the ethereal nature of Valkyries and the famed lesbianism of Amazons. This archetype is so common that it even appears in J.R.R. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings trilogy, with the character of Eowyn. In a throwback to medieval stories, where prophecies are often fulfilled in unexpected ways that are allowed by ambiguous wording, she can kill the Witch King because she is no man. Tolkien even gives her a suitable ending for his 1955 audience. The patient love of Faramir causes all of the hate and war lust to drain out of Eowyn, and she is suddenly filled with love in the form of the desire to marry Faramir and have his children. That said, not all women who went to war came back as women. Albert Cashier was a poor Irish immigrant who served in the Union Army in the American Civil War. Cashier maintained his male gender, even as a captive of the Confederacy, even during a plague of dysentery, which I imagine requires some creativity. His regiment fought in over 40 battles, including Vicksburg. Cashier was 22 when the war ended. He continued to live as a man for another 49 years. Late in life, his mind began to deteriorate, and he was placed in the care of the Watertown State Hospital in Illinois, where his female sex was discovered. He was given only women's clothing for the final year of his life, and was also buried with military honors in 1915. Similarly, Emilio Robles Avila used the Mexican Civil War of the 1910s as an opportunity to escape womanhood. Robles rose to the position of colonel in the Revolutionary Army of the South, the Zapatistas, and was awarded high honors after revolutionary forces won the war. He lived as a man for 61 years until he died at age 95 in 1984. According to a former neighbor, if anyone called Robles a woman or doña, he would threaten them with a pistol, which is certainly one way to defend your gender identity. The last prominent reports of war crossdressers come from the First World War, presumably because in the Second World War, several countries had battalions of women. However, war isn't the only way for girls to make their way into the male ruling order. In 1798, a girl named Margaret Ann Buckley was born in Cork, Ireland. After possibly having an illicit child and finding little success in her chosen profession of tutoring, she worked with her family to secure a spot at the University of Edinburgh's medical school for a fictitious nephew, James Barry. Margaret Ann and James supposedly traveled by ship together to Scotland. James writes, quote, "It was very useful for Mrs. Buckley, my aunt, to have a gentleman to take care of her on board ship, and to have one in a strange country." This letter has a note on the back written by the solicitor who delivered it. It says, "Miss Buckley, 14th of December." James Barry did well in school and found success as an army doctor working in the British colonies. He performed one of the first Caesarean sections where both the child and mother lived. The baby boy was called James Barry Munich, and a relative of his, James Barry Munich Herzog, was Prime Minister of South Africa from 1924 to 39. He ultimately traces his name back to our James Barry. Barry had a particular interest in sanitation and living conditions, and found himself demoted several times and arrested at least once for agitating for better living conditions for soldiers and refugees. Despite their shared passion for sanitation, Barry did not get along with Florence Nightingale when they worked together in Turkey during the Crimean War. He apparently reprimanded Nightingale in a public square at length, and she wrote upon Barry's death that, quote, "I should say that she was the most hardened creature I ever met." Upon Barry's death in 1865 of dysentery, his personal physician produced a death certificate that attests to Barry being male. A woman who handled Barry's body confronted the doctor, essentially blackmailing him, saying he was such a poor doctor that he didn't notice Barry's female body and the pregnancy stretch marks that it bore. She made good on her threat, and thanks to her, we now know about Barry's extraordinary life. The doctor wrote, quote, "Whether Dr. Barry was male, female, or hermaphrodite, I do not know, nor had I any purpose in making the discovery, as I could positively swear to the identity of the body being that of a person who I was acquainted with as Inspector General of Hospitals for a period of years." I suspect that this is probably the healthy approach to take when someone's gender is ambiguous. There are many stories similar to Kavanaugh's and Barry's that we know of, and countless more that were never detected or recorded. There are far fewer examples of the opposite, an assigned male presenting as a woman. A notable exception to this rule is the Chevalier Dion. He lived in 14th century France and came from a declining aristocratic family that had become impoverished. As such, he found employment as secretary to various positions in the French government. He participated in King Louis XV's secret diplomacy and acted as a spy in Russia for 4 years. He later claimed that to get into Russia, he had to dress and act as a maid of honor to the Empress, although this is likely a later justification for his feminine identity. In time, he came to be an interim ambassador to England and thoroughly enjoyed the rewards of office. When the new ambassador was sent to replace him, he found himself in a precarious position between two factions in France. But the Chevalier had a trump card. He had done secret reconnaissance for the French king in England and held evidence of a planned French invasion of England, information that threatened the fragile peace that existed between the two countries after the Seven Years' War. this tense relationship with the ruling faction meant that he continued on in French service, but remained in exile in England. After the death of Louis XV, in 1774, Dion sensed a chance to return to France. He did so by making a unique offer. He claimed that he had been born female and had only assumed male identity to inherit, and suggested that he might return to France as a woman, as a way of recusing himself from the politics that had previously made his return impossible. By quitting manhood, Dion had the opportunity to escape manly obligations. He could now return to France without fighting a duel or otherwise accounting for his tarnished honor. After 14 months of negotiation with the new king, Louis XVI, Dion agreed to return in women's clothing, and the king even provided a stipend for the new wardrobe. Dion's return as a woman was predictably met with a fair amount of scandal and disbelief. It seems that the newly created Mademoiselle Dion never fully adopted feminine roles. She continued to fence and on multiple occasions asked to lead troops, both for Louis XVI and for the revolutionary government that replaced him. A member of French high society, Madame Campan, writes, "The desire to see his native land once more determined him to submit to the condition, and he revenged himself by combining the long train of his gown with three deep ruffles on his sleeves with the attitude and conversation of a grenadier, which made him very disagreeable company." The revolution in 1789 cut Dion off from her only source of income, a pension for government service, and she eventually found herself in debtor's prison at age 76. She was paralyzed by a fall and spent the last 4 years of her life bedridden. The post-mortem analysis claimed that Dion had male organs in every respect perfectly formed, an unusual roundness in the formation of the limbs, as well as a breast remarkably full. This suggests that Dion may have been intersex, expressing male and female physicality. While it's rare for assigned males to live their lives as women, men can adopt femininity temporarily. The earliest records that we have of this are of male prostitutes. A common issue that I ran into researching this topic was the fictionalization of these scandalous lives. Reports often come from after death and are virtually never firsthand. The time that most of these stories focus on, the 17th, 19th century, have a tremendous amount of literature that claims to be true, even if the audience would have been aware that it was not. So that further muddies the waters. That's why I will only quickly mention the case of John or Eleanor Reichner. According to the court record, he or she was caught having sex with a man while wearing women's clothing. In the text, Reichner testifies that he became a prostitute after taking on an apprenticeship with an embroideress who also operated her business as a brothel. Special attention was given to the idea that his or her Johns were primarily clergymen, a medieval trope that Chaucer also uses. He or she discusses both prostituting for men as a woman and seducing women in both men's and women's clothes. Sadly, my research indicates that the Reichner story was a satire of the king, Richard II, written for bureaucrats with anti-monarchical sentiment to giggle over privately. Nevertheless, the story gives us some clues into the medieval Anglo conceptions of gender and sexuality. Reichner is locked in a strange sort of heterosexuality, because when he has sex with a man, he's Eleanor. In his homosexual encounters, he is said to be having sex as a woman. There also seems to be a threat presented to women, in that he can pass in women's spaces while wearing a dress. He's still able to have sex as a man, but wearing the dress allows him access to women that other men do not enjoy. The false binary of gender in the Western world also implies a false binary of sexuality. If you can only imagine two genders, it makes sense to view sexuality as drawn towards either one gender or the other. One of the pioneers of modern concepts of sexuality was Karl Heinrich Urich, who lived in 19th century Germany and was possibly the first out gay man, in that he published under his own name. He campaigned against sodomy laws and wrote defenses of homosexual behavior. He was writing before the terms homosexual and heterosexual had entered common use by scientists, and well before they had trickled down to the general public. In his book, Research on the Riddle of Man-Man Love, Ulrich used poetic rather than scientific language and described sexuality in terms of eros, erotic love, borrowing credibility from Plato. He described himself as a yearning, a female psyche and female love in a male body. The female goddess Aphrodite was said to have been born from the body of the entirely male Uranus. Oryx, by analogy, imagined himself to be a female Aphrodite within his male Uranus body. He imagined homosexuality as a kind of third gender, explainable as a mismatch between the sex and the gender. This classification system was taken up by other German writers, and by the end of the 19th century, we get a delightful array of terms, such as mannerning, which is an effeminate straight man, manling, which would be a butch gay man, and weebling, an effeminate gay man. The Anglo world did not adopt these terms, and eventually settled on the terms homosexual and heterosexual, which were borrowed from scientific literature. But because these terms describe only sexual behavior, not lifestyle or the complex cultural aspects of being queer, they're not especially helpful for us in understanding sexuality prior to their invention. Instead, I'm mostly using the terms and concepts of the people who lived at those times. Earlier, I mentioned that some of the Asian third genders can include non-binary gender as well as effeminate gay men. Most third gender positions seem to be for males who have lost or forsaken their maleness because of non-conforming sexuality, gender, or sex. The West, lacking this position, readily imagined sex between two men as being artificially gendered. Specifically, the receiving partner, the bottom, was imagined to be a woman, however temporarily. The feminized man, an archetype that came to be the screaming queen, holds an especially powerless position in Western society. We see the first explicit mentions of gay men as women in the 18th century. Out of the broad category of sodomy, which included all non-procreative sex acts, gayness begins to imagine itself as a legitimate sexual expression that borrows legitimacy from the idea of marriage. The Buggery Act of 1533 made sodomy a criminal offense in the British Empire, and brought the charge of sodomy into secular courts. Previously, sodomy, which was called buggery in England, had been considered an offense against God, not man, and therefore was prosecuted in the church. It's possible that there were very few prosecutions under the Buggery Act in the 16th and 17th centuries, but it's also possible that that data has simply been obscured or lost or under-researched. All sex acts forbidden by the Act, which included heterosexual, oral, anal, and manual sex, as well as all homosexual sex and bestiality, were strictly taboo subjects. Privately, though, sexuality continued unabated. We know this from diaries. For example, Samuel Pepys, the 17th century diarist, writes about an incident outside of a church when his wife, coming up suddenly, did find me embracing the girl with my hand under her coats, and indeed I was with my main hand in her cunny. In that passage, I've substituted English for the semi-Latin that Pepys used to disclose especially taboo matters. Even in his personal diary, Pepys felt uncomfortable describing his sexual escapades in his native tongue. In the 18th century, a new space opened up in the Anglo world, both physical and cultural, that allowed for the emergence of this illicit third gender called mollies. They emerged in an unusual space, the coffee shop. An increasingly affluent middle class had arisen in Europe, and coffee shops provided a novel public space for both middle class leisure and discussion. Coffee shops provided the space for the architects of democratic revolutions across the European continent. At the same time, women were being pushed out of public life. New ideas of womanhood, and its connection with domesticity, expanded to more completely separate the two genders from each other. In the last episode, I mentioned the impact that this cult of domesticity had on Victoria's body and her happiness during her reign. Men suffered from the expansion of the gender binary as well. New expectations as sole provider for the family placed stress on middle and working class men. Mollies could be seen as an attempt by queer men to construe a non-male identity in this newly segregated gender system. The term molly seems to come from the connection between molly houses and brothels. Molly houses were places where gay men could meet semi-publicly to socialize, cross-dress, hook up, and apparently perform marriages and even births. Moll came to be the term for the stereotyped young Irish woman, who frequently moved to London for work, only to find that that work involved sex. The enemy of the Molls and the Mollies were the Societies for the Reformation of Manners, which were Puritan organizations that sprung up in the wake of the English Civil War. They aimed to make Great Britain properly Protestant by stamping out immorality of all kinds. These organizations worked with private law enforcement to crack down on prostitution and buggery, and most of our information about Mollies comes from these hostile sources. This makes almost all of our information about Mollies suspect, because our sources are highly critical of their lifestyle. The accounts, however, do make for salacious reading. Samuel Stevens, a reforming constable, which is to say a self-appointed morality cop, undertook to infiltrate a Molly house by acting as the husband of a known Molly. On Sunday, November 14th, 1725, he claims to have infiltrated Margaret Clapp's renowned unlicensed coffee shop and Molly house. He describes the scene inside. Quote, "I found between 40 and 50 men making love to one another, as they called it. Sometimes they would sit on one another's laps, kissing in a lewd manner, and using their hands indecently. They would then get up, dance and make curtsies, and mimic the voices of women. Oh, fie, sir! Pray, sir! Dear sir! Lord, how can you serve me so? I swear I'll cry out, 'You're a wicked devil! You're a bold face! Oh, ye dear little Todd! Come, bus!' And they'd hug, and play, and toy, and go out by couples to another room on the same floor, to be married, as they called it." The phrase "to marry" seems to be used as a euphemism for sex. However, Mollies were also known to go through the formality of marriage ceremonies, and some had long-term relationships with men, seemingly happily married, if in secret. Jonathan Wild, who made a career of catching criminals, including Mollies, describes the clothing of a set of Mollies that he captured in a sting operation. Quote, "As the expected time, several of the sporting youngsters were seized in women's apparel and conveyed to the Compter. The next morning they were carried before the Lord Mayor in the same dress they had been taken in. Some were completely rigged in gowns, petticoats, headcloths, fine laced shoes, furbelowed scarves and marks. Some had riding hoods, and some were dressed like milkmaids. Others like shepherdresses, with green hats, waistcoats, and petticoats. And others had their faces patched and painted, and wore extensive hoop petticoats, which had been very lately introduced." Being queer presented an existential threat to these individuals. After the raid on Margaret Clapp's Molly House, Gabriel Lawrence, William Griffin, and Thomas Wright were convicted and hanged. The execution, which also included the horrific burning alive of a female criminal, proved so popular that the stands built for the audience collapsed under the weight of the large crowd, and a further 6 people died of injuries. This was in 1726, not all that long ago. The punishment for sodomy was death, but sodomy required 2 witnesses that could attest to both intercourse and ejaculation. More commonly, people were convicted of attempted buggery, which was punished with pillory, fine, and imprisonment. The punishment of pillory consisted to being bound to a post or put in stocks for public humiliation, usually for an hour. Often the same spot was used for whipping and flogging, which were other common sentences for crimes. Pillory might not sound that bad until you realize that the true punishment was exposure to the vitriol of your peers. All sorts of things, garbage, rocks, human filth, were thrown at a pilloried person, such that it could be a death sentence carried out by the public instead of by an executioner, not dissimilar to a public stoning. Being pilloried for the crime of being a Molly was especially dangerous because of the energy it excited in the crowds. Margaret Clapp, after defending several of her patrons at their sodomy trials, was found guilty of keeping a disorderly house and incitement to buggery. She was pilloried, during which she fainted several times, probably due to head injuries, and fell off the platform at least once. She was carried to the hospital and probably died before her 2-year prison sentence could begin. Charles Hitchin also died of pillory injuries. His experience as a Molly hunter and Molly shows how precariously placed this subculture was in society. Hitchin bought the post of deputy marshal for £700 in 1712 and intended to exploit it to its fullest. The post gave Hitchin the privileges and duties of a thief-taker, a semi-private policeman. Besides the salary and stipend provided by the City of London, Hitchin charged not only for fulfilling his duties, he could expect to be paid by victims of the crimes for the return of their property or the capture of their accused. He also organized crime of his own. With his close connections to the criminal world, he could organize robbery and then either get kickbacks from the sale of the stolen property or the reward for its return, whichever paid better. He offered protection for criminal and semi-criminal operations and became involved in alternately shaking down and raiding Molly houses. His knowledge of Molly houses was intimate. Charles Hitchin, despite his prominence in the community, was a frequent visitor to the Moorfields and St. James's Park, two renowned cruising spots. He had his favorite inns and Molly houses where he would meet with men away from his wife. Hitchin's crime empire became so large that he was obligated to hire an under-marshal, the Jonathan Wild who I quoted above. Wild had his own gangs and ran his own rackets, which sometimes associated with and sometimes competed with Hitchin's. Hitchin lost his deputy marshal post briefly when he prosecuted several children from an Oliver Twist-style pickpocket gang, who were acquitted on testimony from their parents that Hitchin had forced them into the gang in the first place. Wild seized this opportunity to give his gangs precedence over Hitchin's, and a ferocious pamphleting war erupted between the two men as Hitchin fought for his post. Each man accused the other of libel and crimes, but Wild held the ace. He knew that Hitchin slept with men. In what was probably a setup, Hitchin was caught having sex with another man at an inn. Despite all the witnesses to the arrest who could attest to the sex, there was no evidence of ejaculation, so Hitchin was convicted only of assault. Before he paid the £20 fine and underwent the 6 months imprisonment, Hitchin was pilloried. Supporters formed a barrier of coaches and carts, but the angry mob overwhelmed it and forced the constables back up against the pillory platform. Hitchin was showered with such a torrent of rubble and filth that his clothes were torn off. Authorities stopped it after a half hour instead of the customary hour because Hitchin was so close to death. He survived to prosecute three men with assault from the experience, serve his 6 month sentence, and sell his post for the same £700 that he'd bought it for. But he died a month after his release, probably from the pillory injuries. Molly or not, out or not, sodomy remained a serious crime in Britain until the mid-20th century. Executions under the Buggery Act continued until 1835. Oral sex between men and women remained illegal until 1885, when the concept of gross indecency was added, which limited the crime to homosexual acts. Oscar Wilde was convicted of gross indecency a decade later, in 1895, and his punishment of 2 years of hard labor is generally credited with ruining his health and leading to his death 5 years later at age 46. Another particularly notable victim was Alan Turing, who was convicted of gross indecency following testimony he gave about being with a man during a burglary of his home in 1951. The following year, he pled guilty to gross indecency and opted to undergo experimental hormone injections rather than be imprisoned. After a year of injections, he was impotent and had developed breasts. He was barred from his work in the government and academia and denied entry into the U.S. based on this felony conviction. 2 years after the conviction, in 1954, he was found dead, almost certainly by suicide, at age 41. Turing was chemically castrated by the state, a punishment that turns deemed sexual deviants into eunuchs. This is perhaps the last remaining example of castration by the state. The idea is that the eradication of functional gonads will prevent a sexual criminal from engaging in future sexual deviancy. However, we should all be pretty aware that nothing about castration prevents a person from committing sex crimes, any more than it would prevent these eunuchs from seizing power. Laws illegalizing homosexual sex were eliminated in Britain in 1967, and in the United States starting in the 60s and ending in 2003 with Lawrence v. Texas. In the year 2003, you could still get a life sentence for sodomy in Idaho. The practice of chemical castration for sex offenders continues to this day. California passed a law in 1996 that requires chemical castration for certain sex offenders, and the only other option is surgical castration. As recently as 2019, Alabama passed a law allowing for castration as an alternative to death for certain crimes. Castration or death seems like a pretty difficult choice to make. Why can we identify gay voices? The threat of execution for private sexual intercourse had a profound and lasting impact on gay culture. One of these many impacts was felt on language, and it influenced the English language at large. Outside of organized meeting places like Molly houses and later bath houses, gay people needed a way to identify each other. This could include designated cruising spots like the aforementioned Moorfield and St. James's Park, where men could discreetly arrange for homosexual liaisons or prostitution. Some of these spots have been in existence for so long that they've influenced street names. In 2008, a pedestrian underpass in Castleford, England, was renovated and given the new name of Tittlecott Bridge. The Castleford Area Voice for the Elderly, which is a local over 50 organization, successfully petitioned for it to be returned to its original name, Tittlecott Bridge. We can perhaps be grateful that by the 14th century, many of the lanes of England named Grope Cunt had been renamed to the still descriptive but less vulgar Grope Lane. Another way to identify gay peers was to use exploratory code switching. This is where typified behaviors and certain words or certain meanings of words can be used to covertly indicate membership in a community. Here specifically, I'm talking about acting gay, or talking gay. Gay ways of acting and speaking developed in secret and could be deployed semi-publicly without risking the charge of intent to commit buggery. From this covert culture, we get not only the gay affectations of today, but also novel gay language. By the 19th century, bold omis could identify one another by their response to polari. Maybe a man tells another that his cod laddie needs a bonus shushing, meaning that his tacky apartment needs a good redecorating, to see his response.
That example would be laying it on very thick, but hopefully you get the concept.
Polari has given us several gay-adjacent terms, such as camp, to mince, drag, zhuzh, and a new term for masculinity, butch. For the next two centuries, however, polari stayed mostly secret. It's a secret jargon, which is called a cant, and it has roots in the slang of the theater, the circus, the navy, and prostitution, as well as a few random terms borrowed from French and Italian. As a holdover from an earlier time, the term for homosexual sex was to molly. Information on gay language before its outing is rare, because its main value lay in its use as a shibboleth. As with information on mollies, sources we do have tend to come from hostile observers. A hilarious and prominent example was Homosexuality and Citizenship in Florida, a 1964 publication by the Florida Legislature on the preponderance of homosexuality in the state. It was part of a larger Lavender Scare, a movement that used homophobia to seize power for conservative factions. The committee, led by Senator Charlie Johns, had been conducting a witch hunt of homosexuals across all areas of government and had found little success. The Purple Pamphlet, as it was called, was meant to scare the public into action against homosexuals. It described the gay plot to undermine America with communism. You know, the usual 50s stuff. But it also contained images of homosexual sex acts and a description of homosexual slang. It appears that homosexual slang was shared across the Atlantic because we see traces of polari in this document. The Johns plan backfired. Because Johns had essentially published gay porn from the legislature, the backlash was directed at him and eventually led to the dissolution of his committee. Gay clubs of Florida were known to reprint and sell the Purple Pamphlet as pornography for several decades. Ironically, the backlash against Johns' homophobia was itself homophobic. As mentioned earlier, homosexuality was decriminalized in Britain in 1967. This followed a series of cultural changes. In the 50s, several prominent lords were tried for homosexuality, and a committee formed by the conservative government to investigate found that, quote, homosexual behavior between consenting adults in private should no longer be a criminal offense. Culture began to shift, and stereotyped gay characters began to appear in radio and television as joyful and comic, rather than morose and doomed, as homosexuals had been treated through the first half of the 20th century. In 1965, the world was introduced to the cant called polari via Julian and Sandy.
Hello, anybody there?
Oh, hello, I'm Julian, and this is my friend Sandy.
Oh, hello!
Julian and Sandy was a recurring sketch on the radio program Round the Horn, where our straight man, Kenneth Horn, unknowingly contracts Julian and Sandy, who work a wide variety of odd jobs, usually as shop attendants, and mistake Horn's innocent questions for Polari innuendo. This was the coming out of gay language.
So here's an example from a sketch where Sandy is running for office. In this, he's laying on the Polari thick for comedic purposes, but hopefully from the context, you're able to gather what a lot of these words meant.
Homies and Polones of this borough!
That's lovely. Oh, lovely.
We are poised at a moment in history. Lovely. The future could be naff.
Naff.
Or it could be boner.
Boner.
The time has come for a frank and honest Varda at our awkward position.
Oh, yes, that's true.
I am questing after this seat. For the good of my fellow homies.
Yeah.
Let us not mince.
Have you taken leave of this?
I haven't finished. Let us not mince words.
Oh.
Let us put our best lally forward. And with our eeks shining with hope, stroll together towards the fantabulosa futurette.
It led directly to the death of Polari as a language. Once it was commonly understood, once it had entered the comic mainstream, it no longer had value as a cant. So, not long after Julian and Sandy, we get Monty Python making jokes like this.
Yes. Are there any regiments which are more effeminate than others?
Well, no, sir. I mean, apart from the Marines, they're all dead butch.
The outing of Polari and the general outing of homosexuality in the 70s invited outside observers into gay culture, lending it legitimacy and authority, but relegating aspects of covert homosexual culture into shameful artifacts of the past. Screaming queen depictions of homosexuality, like Julian and Sandy, have come to be seen as a harmful stereotype. The depiction of gay man as queen, however, has found a legitimate place in gay culture and mainstream culture. Probably the most prominent example of this has been RuPaul's Drag Race, a TV competition show that just finished its 12th season. It started on the LGBT-oriented Logo TV, but was picked up by VH1 in its 9th season, and has averaged around 600,000 viewers per episode. Drag queens are mainstream. Drag queens make explicit an undercurrent of gay male language and culture, which is its supposed effeminacy. It makes clear the link to the Molly Houses of yesteryear. In our culture, a connection is made between being a gay man and being a woman that doesn't necessarily exist. As such, gay male culture constructs a new femininity based on ideas about women that come from men and aren't necessarily shared by women. Studies into gay male speech, as spoken by North Americans, have shown that it's distinct from how straight women speak. It's a distinct gendering of language that mimics, but is not part of the gender binary of Western culture. This brings us to the end. I hope that these stories have given you some insight into the experiences that exist and have always existed around the borders of binary gender. It's a distinctly Western meme that has come to dominate the world that previously was populated extensively by third genders. Even in the West, there have always been folks for whom gender and sexuality binary simply don't work. This world has always been much queerer and more sexual than our histories tend to let on. So whether you're asexual or bisexual, if you're a bull dyke or a screaming queen, whether you're peeing through a tube to be one of the guys or tucking to be one of the girls, know that you stand with an extensive hidden history behind you. And there are times and places, many in the past and hopefully many, many more in the future, that would have suited your needs better than the Western binary system of today. It's not you, it's them, I promise. I'm Peter McGuire, and this has been my unlikely explanation.
Thank you. The theatre has beckoned.
Yes.
The theatre is beckoned.
Come
We're
on.
Planning the return of Jewel in a show which is more mysterious than Phantom of the Opera, more feline than cats, more puzzling than chess, more miserable than Les Miserables. Oh, what a show. Oh, tell him about it.
No, I don't like to.
Go on, force yourself.
No.
Force
no.
yourself. He might put money into it. He's got a bit.
Well, tell him about I'll it. Play this miserable phantom, you
That's
see,
right.
with a tortured eek,
yes.
who's dressed up like a cat that plays chess.
How does that grab you?
It's grabbed.